Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. Right now we have an hour ahead of us to take your calls if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith. And although it looks like our lines have just filled up, it's amazing how, you know, even though lines are full, once we go through some of these calls by, 10, 15 minutes into the program, there's often a line or two open up. So if you called at this time, you'll get a busy signal. But if you call in a few minutes, perhaps not. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And our first caller today is Richard from Massachusetts. Richard, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. So I guess I have a two-part question for you. It would be, I've been speaking to a friend who has a Christian Orthodox background, and I'm trying to explain to him about apostolic succession and the fact that the Word has authority over doctrine and not the bishops. And so I'm just wondering how you would go about that. And I guess the second part of my question is, I know a big part of the way they establish their doctrine is with the verse where Jesus said, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. And I guess what do you think that verse means and how to go about explaining that to him?
Okay. Well, both the Roman Catholics and the Orthodox believe in apostolic succession. They disagree, of course, as to which church has the legitimate successor of the apostles, which, of course, is problematic. I don't believe in apostolic succession. The view of the church is that when the first generation of the apostles died off, they left other people, bishops of churches, in charge in their place. And when those bishops died, they left others in their place. And that there's always been, for example, a continual succession of bishops of Rome. Now, the Catholic Church, and I'm less familiar with the specific way that this is argued by the Orthodox Church, but I would imagine it would be similar. The Roman Catholic Church, I know, teaches that Peter had priority over the other apostles, and they teach that he was the first bishop of Rome. And therefore, the bishop of Rome in any generation, because he's the successor of Peter's seat as bishop in Rome, is the head over the other bishops and other churches around the world. Now, there's absolutely nothing in the Bible to support that. Now, they do use Matthew 16, where Jesus said, "You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church." Now, it is true that the name Peter means a rock, or many people say it means a little rock. And when he said, "Upon this rock I'll build my church," he used a different word, Petra. Some people think that that's significant, that he's referring to himself, or perhaps on Peter's confession, as the great rock, the Petra, upon which the church is built, and that Peter is simply a little rock, a Petros. Now, this may be true. I've heard Catholics argue against this argument, saying that Petros is simply the masculine form of Petra, and the word rock in Greek is female, Petra. And if you're going to nickname a man by that name, you'd simply put that in a masculine form. So they would deny that Petros means a diminutive of a rock and Petra, a big rock. They just say Petros is the masculine form of the word Petra. And they may be right. I don't really know. It's never been a problem to me to see him speaking of Peter as that rock, though I'm not sure that he is. Peter doesn't refer to himself that way when he's talking about rocks and the church being built and so forth. In 1 Peter chapter 2, Peter talks about himself as being a living stone along with all the other readers of his epistle. They're all living stones. He says in verse 5 of 1 Peter 2, "You also as living stones are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." So we are all living stones. And he goes on to say, that Jesus is the cornerstone. He says in the verse next, Therefore, it also contained in the scripture, "Behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, elect precious, and he who believes on him will by no means be put to shame." Now, he's referring to Jesus there as the chief cornerstone. He's quoting Isaiah 28:16, where it actually says, "I lay in Zion for a foundation, a chief cornerstone." So in the verse that Peter's quoting about Jesus, it actually says in the original, he's the foundation. Therefore, Jesus would be the rock upon which the church is built. And Peter seems to know that and acknowledge that. He doesn't call himself the rock. He just acknowledges that Christians are living stones being built into a spiritual house. But the foundation and cornerstone is Jesus. So Peter doesn't seem to know that he is supposed to hold a special position of honor in terms of rocks in the building. Now, if Jesus was referring to Peter and saying, you know, you are the rock upon, or I built my church upon this rock, I could accept that, because it says in Ephesians chapter 2 that the church is built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets. So he'd be speaking to Peter as simply as an apostle along with the other apostles. I'm going to build the church upon the apostles, of which you are one of them. And it says that in Ephesians chapter 2 in verse 20, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. Once again, Jesus being the prominent one, not Peter, in whom the whole building being joined together grows into a holy temple in the Lord. So both Peter and Paul quote Isaiah 28:16, which says that Jesus is the foundation and cornerstone of the church. And then Paul says that the apostles and prophets are foundation stones, apparently laid upon Christ, who's the subfloor. They must be built on top of him. And then, you know, as Peter says, all the Christians are living stones. So none of these passages really suggest that they understood Jesus' words in Matthew 16 to be placing any real priority on Peter personally. Certainly there's priority on the apostles as a group. But let's allow it. I mean, just because it's an unsettled matter, there Protestants have different views than Catholics have about this, and the Orthodox have. But let's just say, let's give them that for the sake of argument. Let's just say that Jesus is telling Peter that as one of the apostles, he is going to be a foundation stone, and the church will be built upon him. Okay, fine. But where's any record of an apostolic succession? Okay, I can agree that the apostles had a unique foundational role to play in the church. I don't see anything hinted that there will be apostles of their same kind and of their same status a generation later or the generation after that. It's true that the historian Eusebius does mention a lineage of bishops from various churches. He talks about Antioch, he talks about Rome, he talks about several. And of course, in the second generation, there was a bishop in each of these churches and and generations afterwards. But that doesn't mean that the bishops were the same thing as apostles. The word apostle is a special word. And it says in 1 Corinthians 12 that God gave first of all apostles, secondarily prophets, third teachers. Now the bishops are teachers, the overseers, the episcopoi. They're the ones who teach the church. So the teachers are several rungs below an apostle in importance. So if it is true, and I don't believe it is, but if it is true that Peter was the first bishop of Rome, that doesn't mean that the second bishop of Rome was also an apostle. It just means that Peter, an apostle, happened to occupy the position of a bishop. But that doesn't mean that all bishops are apostles. That's silly. Now, the Bible talks about lots of bishops, even in the time of the apostles, and they were never considered to be the same thing as an apostle. So the idea of apostolic succession is simply a man-made doctrine. Now, sometimes they point to the idea that Judas had to be replaced when he died. But that's because Judas ceased to be an apostle. He defected. He left the faith. And he left a vacancy. However, when James was the apostle was killed in Acts chapter 12, no one considered replacing him. And the reason is because when an apostle dies faithful, he remains an apostle. Judas did not remain faithful. He left his place as a Christian and as an apostle. He did leave a vacuum. But the other apostles did not. They remain the 12 apostles. When John is called caught up into heaven, he sees the New Jerusalem, and there's 12 foundation stones. And each one has the name of one of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. There are not millions of apostles. or thousands of them, or hundreds, as far as we know. But there are the 12. And, of course, there are other people called apostles in the Bible, but they're not the same thing as the bishops. So the idea that the bishops of the church are apostolic successors of Peter and the other apostles doesn't make sense to me. And more than that, a big deal is made about how the Pope or the Bishop of Rome is a successor of Peter. But which church, which apostle was the Bishop of Antioch succeeding, or the Bishop of Alexandria, or the Bishop of Ephesus, or the Bishop of Corinth, or the Bishop of Galatia, or the Galatian Church, or the bishops? Which apostles were they succeeding? There were a lot more bishops, even in the first generation of Christians, than there were apostles. Which of these bishops, which 12, were the actual successors of the 12 apostles? I don't think anyone has ever made an argument that that is the case, because being a bishop isn't the same thing as being an apostle, even if you live in the same town and are overseeing the same church that an apostle once oversaw. So that'd be my answer to the question of apostolic succession. I hope that helps. All right, we've got Tim from Turner, Oregon. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Tim. Thanks for calling.
Hi. If you have time, I have a couple of questions. My first one is, I was having a conversation with somebody, and they told me that God has a different standard for Jews than for Gentiles. And when I heard that, I thought that sounded kind of strange. And their reasoning behind that was, when Jesus sent out the disciples, he told them to go to the household of Israel and to not to go to the Samaritans or the Gentiles. And then he says that if one of those villages refuses their words to shake the dust off their feet, and then he says it'll be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for that city. And from that, he deduced that God has a different, stricter standard for Jews than for Gentiles. And I just thought maybe you could, that doesn't really make any sense to me.
No, you mean for judgment? No, that doesn't follow. What Jesus was saying is that if Sodom and Gomorrah had seen the signs that, let's say, Capernaum had seen, Jesus did most of his signs and wonders in Capernaum, but they rejected him. He said if Sodom and Gomorrah had seen such things, they would have repented. And Nineveh repented without any such signs when they heard the preaching of Jonah. So what Jesus is saying is there are pagans like Sodom and Gomorrah and Nineveh that will have an easier time at the judgment, a lighter judgment, than the people whom Jesus preached to personally and who saw his miracles, because those people either repented or did not. But Sodom and Gomorrah did not, Nineveh did, but they did so without, whatever they did, they did so without seeing any miracles. And so Sodom and Gomorrah was not justified in rejecting God or righteousness, but they had no Bible. They'd never heard, the Ten Commandments. They'd never, they didn't know anything about Jesus. They'd never seen any signs or wonders. And that doesn't excuse them for being so wicked. But it does mean that anyone who has had a Bible, anyone who has seen the signs and the wonders that Jesus gave and still doesn't believe, is definitely in a different situation in terms of innocence, in terms of ignorance, than were these cities who never had any revelation from God or miracles. So what Jesus is saying, I believe, is that those who have more information are going to be judged more severely. Now, it is true the Jews as a people did have more information than the Gentiles through many of those centuries. That hasn't been the case ever since the apostles' time, because there's been more preaching among the Gentiles than among the Jews ever since the first generation. So if your friend is saying, well, the Jews today are going to be judged more harshly than the Gentiles, I think he's wrong. I think all people are judged the same way. And, because Jews today don't have more information about Jesus than Gentiles do. It's about equally available to everybody. Now, Paul actually addressed this matter, showing that your friend is wrong. In this passage in Romans chapter 2, he says in chapter 2, verse 6 of Romans, that God will render to each one according to his deeds at the judgment. Then he says eternal life to those who by patient continuance in doing good seek for glory, honor, and immortality, but to those who are self-seeking and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, indignation and wrath, tribulation and anguish on every soul of man that does evil, on the Jew first and also on the Greek, but glory, honor, and peace to everyone who works what is good, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. So he's saying the same policies apply to the Jew and to the Greek. It's understood that they applied to the Jew because, I mean, that goes without saying because of their long-standing revelation they've had from God. But what Paul's point is, it applies to the Greek too. I mean, not just the Jew. The Jew was first chronologically, but the Greeks too are in the same boat. Those who seek righteousness will receive righteousness. Those who seek sin and selfishness will receive, condemnation. And that's to the Jew and the Greek both. The Jew, of course, had the opportunity first, but that's not necessarily saying that the opportunity they had keeps them permanently in a different position than the Gentiles, because today the average Gentile probably has had more exposure to Jesus than the average Jew has. So, it's not a question of race. It's a question of response to the light that somebody has. That's really what Jesus and Paul are talking about.
That makes perfect sense. You have time for another question?
Well, go ahead.
Well, Daniel 12:2, where it says, "And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt." And the traditionalist view of hell uses that verse, which I listened to your verse by verse teaching on this section. And I don't, you said that verse doesn't have anything to do with hell, which, I mean, even if it did, it doesn't, it in no way says anything about people being tormented forever and ever.
Right. Well, let me just jump in here. I won't say that it absolutely cannot have anything to do with hell. I'm not going to be that firm, because what I do say when I teach Daniel 12 is there's some things about it that are very hard to interpret. And some of the things I'm not quite sure about, but I will tell you what my general understanding of Daniel 12 is. And that is that this reference, it sounds like a reference to the future resurrection of the dead, is probably not. It's probably talking about what happened in AD 70. Now, the reason for that is because chapter 12 begins with the words, "At that time, Michael shall stand up." At what time? Well, at the time that's described in chapter 11. Now, some people, because they want Daniel 12 to be about the end times and the final resurrection, they try to make chapter 11 be about the end times. In fact, they try to make the king who begins to be discussed in Daniel 11:36 to be a future Antichrist, so that by the time it has discussed the future Antichrist, we now have to say at that time, meaning at the time of the Antichrist, Michael will stand up and there'll be this tribulation and so forth. But actually, there's no reason to see this individual at the end of Daniel 11 as a future Antichrist, because Daniel 11 has been going through the history of the Jews under the Seleucids and the Ptolemies through the whole chapter, and the last of the Seleucids mentioned is in the verses just before this, in verses 32 through 35, which are talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, and which was 167 years before Christ. And then it says, "Then the king shall do according to his own will," and so forth. That king, to jump thousands of years from Antiochus Epiphanes to make it a future Antichrist who's never appeared, is 100% arbitrary. And it seems very unlikely, since there's been a series of kings throughout the whole chapter that followed each other very rapidly. The idea that there's some gap here. What the dispensationalists do is throw gaps in wherever they want them. Even though Daniel talks about things that were fulfilled in the time of Christ, dispensationalists want to believe they have not been fulfilled in the time of Christ, but they'll be fulfilled in the last days. So what they have to do is they have to stick big gaps places. They have to stick a big gap of 1,500 years between the ankles and the feet of the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in chapter 2. They have to stick a gap of 2,000 years between the 69th and the 70th week of Daniel in chapter 9. And here they stick well over 2,000 years between verses 35 and 36 in Daniel, which there's no suggestion that it should be. Now, what I'm saying is the dispensationalists artificially, without biblical warrant, make these passages apply to the end times. And I don't believe they do. I believe in the context, the last king mentioned is Herod, or else, or the Herod family, or the Romans, which Herod was a representative of. And it was during the Roman times that the nation went through its great tribulation that Jesus spoke about in Matthew 24:21, which Jesus said would be in that generation, his own generation. So I believe that Daniel 12 is talking about things that happened in that generation. And it says, many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Now, this is something that, of course, sounds like it's about the resurrection from the dead. But then so does Ezekiel 37 sound like the resurrection of the dead in the prophecy of the dry bones, which form into bodies and so forth. But that's clearly not about the resurrection of the dead. That's about the restoration of Israel, especially Judea, from Babylon. I mean, the passage tells us that. So the imagery of dead bodies rising is a figurative term in many passages in the Old Testament. I think it is here. And one reason I say so is because it says many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. Apparently not all, but many of them. Now, when Jesus talked about the resurrection in John 5:28, he said, in that hour, all who are in the grave shall hear his voice and come forth. So Jesus talks about the resurrection as including everyone who's in the grave. This talks about many of those who sleep. Now, the language here, in my opinion, sounds more like that of Simeon in Luke chapter 2, and Simeon came when Jesus was a baby and he blessed the baby and so forth. He said in verse 34, Luke 2:34, he says, Simeon blessed them and said to Mary, his mother, behold, this child is destined for the fall and the rising of many in Israel, for a sign which will be spoken against. Now, many, and he's going to cause many to fall and many to rise. Actually, the word rising there in the Greek is anastasis, which means resurrection. Jesus is going to cause many to fall and many to resurrect. But this is not, in my opinion, talking about the end times, because Jesus said in Matthew 5:24, whoever hears my words and believes in him that sent me has everlasting life, and will not come into condemnation because he has passed from death unto life. Paul said that when we were born again, we were made alive, having been dead in trespasses and sins. Both Jesus and Paul speak about Christians having been reborn as having experienced a spiritual resurrection. And I believe that the many who would rise would be the believers, and the many who would fall would be the Jews who rejected him and who their whole nation collapsed in AD 70. So this is, you know, just trying to compare scripture with scripture here, if I can. Also, I would bring in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verses 10 through 12, where Peter said that the prophets inquired to know what they were talking about when they were talking about the salvation that we have experienced. And it says that God told them it's not for them to know. Well, the only case in the Old Testament that Peter could possibly be referring to is Daniel chapter 12, because Daniel 12 has Daniel asking that very question. What shall the end of these things be? And God tells him it's not for you to know. And that's the only place that any prophet is told such a thing. So Peter must have this passage in mind when he says, when they prophesied of the grace that would come to you, to us, to the first generation of Christians he's writing to, he's talking about things that happened in the first generation of Christians. And he said, those are the things the prophets were told are not for them to know about. So he's apparently identifying Daniel 12 as being about things that were fulfilled in the lives of the New Testament Christians in the first century. So those are my reasons for not seeing it as a reference to the final resurrection.
Okay, yeah, that helps quite a bit. The everlasting life thing is what...
Well, yeah, we receive... Jesus said, whoever hears my words and believes in me has everlasting life. So these people have awakened, and they have passed from death unto life, he says. So having believed in Jesus, we have passed from death to life. We have awakened. We were asleep in the dust, as it were, and we've awakened to everlasting life. Others woke up to their fate when the Romans came and slaughtered them. I mean, they woke up to shame and everlasting contempt. It doesn't say everlasting torment. You see, a lot of people read that as if it's talking about people being tormented in hell. It doesn't talk about any torment. Yeah. It talks about shame and contempt. Yeah. And in other words, shame came on the Jewish race and they became a persecuted people held in contempt for a very long time. So, I mean, that's what happened to them when they were destroyed by the Romans. So yeah. There's no particular reference to hell here. Now, of course, I won't say that I couldn't be wrong, because I could be wrong about just about anything. But I used to think the other way until I compared Scripture with Scripture. And doing that made me think differently. And so at least I know why I used to think the other way, and I realize there's no basis for it. And I know why I think what I do now, because there is a basis for it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, God bless you. I need to take a break here, and we'll be coming back. We have 30 minutes more, so don't think we're done. Don't go away. We have some of the lines have opened up, and we'll be taking the calls of all that we can in the next half hour. And I'll give the number out again after this brief break. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, that's the only way we stay on the air. And you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, where you can donate, but everything is free at thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Don't go away.
The book of Hebrews tells us, do not forget to do good and to share with others. So let's all do good and share The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg with family and friends. When the show is over today, tell one and all to go to thenarrowpath.com, where they can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. And be sure to tell them to tune into the show right here on the radio. Share listener-supported The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share and do good.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions you'd like to ask about the Bible or the Christian faith, this is one place you can ask. You can ask other places too, but why not get a second opinion? The number to call is 844-484-5737. And though there's one line open now, it'll probably fill up fast. And if you call and all the lines are full, you'll probably get a busy signal, or your phone will tell you the number's out of service, which will not be correct. But some people get that message through their phone service. But the thing is, you can call back usually in a few minutes, and a line will probably open up. Right now, there's one line open. It's 844-484-5737. And our next caller is Rodney from Michigan. Rodney, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Before I ask my question, just one quick comment about the previous caller that you were talking about.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't it, at the end of Daniel 11, just before it gets into chapter 12, doesn't it use the phrase at the time of the end? Wouldn't that put, like, those events happening at the, you know, just before the second coming?
Well, it depends on the end of what. I believe that the end of the Jewish system was much more on the mind of the Jews, and much more something to be discussed at that time than the end of the world, because the end of the world was still thousands of years off, but the end of the Jewish system, not quite so much. And it'll be to Daniel's people. See, all these prophecies have to do with Daniel's people. So the end of Daniel's people as a nation, would be the time of the end of that would be very significant to them. The end of the world, I don't think they even had any thoughts about that subject, nor did they need to. They were very far off from that point. But the end of their nation was certainly within seeing distance.
Okay. Yeah, it just seems like when the phrase time of the end, it just seems like he was referring to the end of times, like before
Jesus
comes back.
That's how we've been taught. That's how we've been taught to think of it. But if in Daniel's day, I don't think they had any thoughts about that. Yeah.
Okay. My question comes from Mark chapter 13. I think you were taught, I kind of caught half your program the other day. I think you were some guy was asking about, like, when the disciples asked Jesus about When shall the signs be of his coming, and you know, when the temple would be destroyed.
Yeah.
And I think you had said like most of that was talking about 70 AD, like when it talks about the abomination of desolation. Yep. And like your flight being on the, not being in the winter, the Sabbath day. Was that correct?
Yes.
My question in Mark chapter 13 is like when Jesus goes through and explains all those events, like I think he mentions one or two times during when he was describing it, he was saying in those days, like in those days, they shall deliver you up and be persecuted. He actually uses the phrase in those days.
Uh-huh.
And then like he uses that, I think one or two times. And then when you go down to verse 24 of Mark 13, he said, in those days after that tribulation, then the sun shall be darkened. It
right.
seems like the phrase those days is all referring to the events right before he comes, because it, he says, in those days after the tribulation, then the sun shall be darkened, and you'll see the sign of the Son of Man. So even though, like, when I read it, when I read those verses, like, I know he briefly does talk about 70 AD when he says, you know, not one stone will be left on another, but I believe his main emphasis was on his second coming. You know, I think that points it out when he uses the term those days.
And do you think that's how the disciples were expected to understand it?
Well, they ask him that question about the when would he come back?
Well, not in Mark 13, they didn't.
Well, Mark 13 and Matthew 24 is describing the same thing.
Just, right. But
you know,
I believe that
just different people wrote it down according
to
their view of how they heard it.
I agree, but both Mark and Luke also has to be thrown in there too. Luke 21, Mark and Luke.
Yep.
Yeah, Mark and Luke apparently did not know of any question about the second coming of Christ because they didn't include any such question. And in my opinion, what you have interpreted as a question about the second coming of Christ in Matthew 24:3 is not really about that at all. But it's more like what Mark and Luke were talking about. Mark and Luke say that what the disciples asked about was when would the time come for the temple to be destroyed, and what sign would there be that the temple is about to be destroyed? And Jesus answers both those questions. Now, in Matthew, which is the gospel that retains all the Jewish idioms more than the others, they ask, "What is the when shall these things be?" That's the first question in all three gospels, and the second question in all three gospels is, "What shall be the sign?" Now, the way that finishes in Matthew uses a Jewish idiom, "What shall be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" In the other Gospels, it's "What shall be the sign that these things," which, of course, is talking about the destruction of the temple, "what shall be the sign that these things are about to take place?" So there's two questions there, and Matthew words it differently because I believe he words it the way the disciples did as Jews. But I think that Mark and Luke have paraphrased it to make it easier for non-Jews to understand the question, which the disciples had a Jewish idiom referring to your coming. They didn't have any idea he was going. Are you aware of that? They didn't know he was going to be gone. So they wouldn't really be asking about his second coming because it took them by surprise when he left.
But my question was in Mark 13:24, he says in those days.
Right.
And like in Matthew 24, you know, he describes like, "Pray that your flight be not in the winter, nor on the Sabbath day, the abomination of desolation." And Jesus said, "In those days, you know, they will deliver you up." And then
I'll tell you what. Hang on a minute. Go ahead and listen to my free lectures on the Olivet Discourse, and then call me back with these questions because I go over.
I'm frustrated because you didn't answer my question, though.
Like, well, I don't have time to answer all the points you're making. But I certainly can. I just don't want the other, you know, half a dozen people who want to get on before the show is over to have to sit and listen to a long thing that has already been answered. I mean, if you were the only caller on here, I'd spend the rest of the half hour answering every point you have. But I really can't do that. You've got one after another.
Well,
so just go to.
You didn't answer the question, though, but I appreciate it.
Well, I do believe I did. But if I didn't, I'll tell you where you can find the answer. The answer can be found at thenarrowpath.com. Under topical lectures, and find the series called When Shall These Things Be? And you'll find I have lectures there on the Olivet Discourse, and I answer far more questions than you've ever had about it, including the ones you asked. And how do I know that? Because I was a dispensationalist once too, and I had all the questions. And when I teach, I try to answer the questions I myself had, and that's what those lectures do. I appreciate your call, though. Let's try to get some other people in here before we run out of time. Jody from Rockland, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
A friend of mine is a big fan of John MacArthur. I, in the past, have not been a great fan of his, but I've been listening to some of his messages and enjoying them. They're solid messages. I just listened to one yesterday, kind of addressing the COVID-19 thing we're all going through. Mm-hmm. And in it, he mentioned Paul's thorn in the flesh, and his interpretation was some evil demonic influence within the Corinthian church, and that was the thorn in the flesh that he was referring to. And that just kind of blew my mind. I'd never heard that interpretation before. It seemed like a bit of a unnecessary reach or interpretation. So I guess what I'm wondering is your interpretation of that and overall your impression of John MacArthur and his teachings.
Well, John MacArthur is quite a dynamic teacher, he loves the Bible. I think he loves the Lord. I differ with him on theology on a number of things. He's a dispensationalist. I'm not. He's a Calvinist. I'm not. He's a cessationist. I'm not. So we have some pretty big areas of difference, but that wouldn't prevent him and me from both, if we are determined to do so, following the Lord and making disciples. He could make disciples. I could make disciples even with these different views. And so it's, they're not, they don't end the possibilities of, let's say, he and I having fellowship. They might in his mind, but they wouldn't for me. Because I get along with a lot of people who disagree with me. Now, as far as that particular argument that the thorn in the flesh was a demonic power in Corinth coming against Paul, I understand the reason, because Paul did say in 2 Corinthians 12 that it's a messenger of Satan sent to buffet him. But exactly what form did this buffeting take? Literally, was Paul being beat up in his sleep, and wake up with bruises all over him because this thing was buffeting him, which means beating him up? Or is that a figure of speech? Is it the case that Satan has been allowed to bring sickness of some kind to Paul? And I think it is that way, because when Paul says that Jesus then said to him, "My grace is sufficient for you, my strength is made perfect in weakness," Paul says, "Oh, well, then I will gladly endure. I'll rejoice in my infirmities." In fact, in the next verses, he talks about his problem as an infirmity a couple of times. Now, the word infirmity in the Greek is the most common word in the New Testament for a sickness. And in fact, when Matthew 8:17 quotes from Isaiah 53, he quotes it that Jesus took our infirmities. He carried our infirmities and took our pains. And that's a word for sickness. In Galatians, Paul said to the Galatians, "You remember that when I was among you, it was because of physical infirmity that I came to you." So we know that Paul had sickness. Whether his thorn in the flesh is a reference to such a sickness or not could be questioned, although he does refer to it apparently as an infirmity in the very passage where he talks about it. And I believe that the devil, a messenger of Satan, could bring a physical sickness to him, just like Satan brought physical sickness to Job, for example. Now, the other thing is, Paul was not in Corinth when he was writing to the Corinthians. He was in Ephesus. And yet he writes as though he has not been relieved of this. He says, "I asked God three times to take it away, and he said, 'My grace is sufficient for you.'" And indicating that Jesus said, "I'm not going to take it away. I'm going to give you grace." And Paul says, "Okay, therefore I rejoice in it." Now, Paul's talking about it as if it's a current situation, even when he's in Ephesus. So if it was a demonic thing, it followed him around. It wasn't just in Corinth. There's a third view, and that is that it's some person who Paul refers to as a messenger of Satan, some persecutor that followed him around. However, the book of Acts, although it does mention people persecuting Paul in every city, we don't read of any particular person who followed him around from place to place and was a constant annoyance to him. There may be a possibility for other views on this, but I think the evidence available points to it being a sickness.
Okay. All right.
All right.
I would agree, and I appreciate your input. Thank you.
Okay, Jody. God bless you. Thanks for your call. All right. Robert from Yuma City, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two quick questions, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
I'm reading back through the Gospel of John, and specifically say through chapters 7 through 10, One thing I've heard stated before about the religious leaders, the Pharisees, scribes, and priests, some people have said that they didn't really understand who Jesus was, that he really was the Son of God or Messiah. And I've heard other people say over the years that they knew exactly who he was. Mm-hmm. So that's my first question. And the second one is, even though maybe it should seem clear, but I just like to clarify it for myself, why do you think they wanted to kill him? And that's my two questions.
Well, okay. Did the Pharisees know that Jesus was the Son of God? I think we'd have to assume some of them really did, and some probably didn't. It's not the case that everybody in a particular room is going to have the same opinion about a third party who's not there. Jesus, when he told the parable of the vineyard and the tenants of the vineyard, which he himself, the Bible itself says he was speaking about the Pharisees when he talked about the tenants of the vineyard. It says when the master sent his son to get the fruit, they said, "This is the heir. Let us kill him and we'll keep the vineyard for ourselves." Now, Jesus portrayed the motivation of the tenants as recognizing that this person was the son of the owner and that by killing him, they could keep the vineyard for themselves, they thought. Now, it says in one of the Gospels, after Jesus gives that parable, which is found in three Gospels, it says the Pharisees knew he was talking about them. So they must have recognized in themselves people who knew he was the son, knew he was the heir, and wanted to get rid of him so that he wouldn't supplant them in their position of leadership. I believe their motives were political. Now, when Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, they don't know what they are doing," it's possible that he was talking about the Romans, who certainly didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know who he was, who were crucifying him. But Peter, in Acts chapter 3, gives a sermon where he tells the Jews, "I know that you did this in ignorance to Jesus, and so did your leaders." So Peter recognizes that some of the leaders, probably most of the people on the Sanhedrin, didn't really know that Jesus was the Son of God. They didn't know who he was. They didn't follow him around like some of the Pharisees did. I think the Pharisees who followed him around had no excuse for not knowing that he was the Son of God because of the works he did. He said, "If you don't believe me, believe the works." But the Sanhedrin were not people who were traveling around following, watching Jesus. And I think that a lot of them didn't know. I don't think they had as much information. I think they knew the rumors, but they, you know, I think they just didn't know that whether it was true or not. So I think that the Sanhedrin that put him to death, some members of it probably were ignorant. And those are probably the ones that Peter's referring to. I know your leaders did this in ignorance, but not all of them were ignorant. I mean, actually, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus were members of the Sanhedrin, and they knew enough about Jesus to believe in him. So some believed in him, some were probably ignorant, and some knew it was him, but wanted to get rid of him because of the threat he posed. You see, if you say, why did they kill him? I believe that no one wanted to kill him except the leaders. And the motivation they had was because he made them look bad and threatened their position. They had a pretty cushy situation there. They were pretty well to do. People respected them. They had a good job. And they were in charge. They had power, money. I mean, these are kind of things that carnal people are motivated to try to hold on to. And if Jesus had succeeded, he would have turned the people against them because he's always saying, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees," or "You people, don't be like the hypocrites, you know, don't be like the Pharisees." And he was always showing the Pharisees to be fools. Whenever they'd attack him, he always gave them an answer that they couldn't answer back. I mean, he was a threat to their prestige and to their power. And so it was just an annoyance to them because they couldn't beat him in popularity and they couldn't beat him in debate. So I think they just felt like we just got to get rid of him. And so that's my...
Well, whether they knew who he was or not, it was all about, well, just
right.
The sin that they were
right.
Out for
it was a political thing. They got rid of him for political reasons. They claimed that they did it for religious reasons. They accused him of blasphemy, but that was on the basis of him saying he was the Son of God. And it's very clear there was no precedent in Jewish law for someone who says they're the Son of God being accused of blasphemy. Jesus himself pointed out that in their own scriptures, it says, "I said you are gods." And he said, now, if your scriptures called the people who received them, gods, then why would you want to stone me for calling myself the Son of God? I mean, there certainly would be no precedent in Israel for calling a person a blasphemer who says the Son of God. But that's what they used as a pretext. Notice they didn't use that when they came to Pilate. They didn't come to Pilate and say, this guy needs to die because he's a blasphemer. They said, no, he's stirring up the people against Rome. In other words, they changed even what the accusation was when they came to the Romans. They were lying. They knew neither accusation was true. They just needed to get rid of him. I appreciate your call, brother. I need to give some more people a chance because the clock is ticking and there's very many people waiting. God bless you. I hope that helps. Chris from San Diego, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve, God bless you, brother. I just wanted to seek a perspective and just ask if you can shed some light on Luke 16, 19 through 31. Mm-hmm. Just kind of missing the point of what happened to the rich man that caused him to be sent? Was it his unwillingness to help Lazarus or his his love for mammon?
Well, it's an interesting thing that the rich man who found himself in Hades, tormented in flames, is mm-hmm. is not described as being a gross sinner, but he was just a callous man who didn't help the poor when he could. I mean, he was a selfish man, and that certainly would be enough to condemn him. But the Lazarus, the man who found himself in the presence of Abraham in a more comfortable place, he's not really described anywhere as a particularly righteous man. It doesn't say that he was a believer or that he did good deeds. Mm-hmm. And so the story is not there to illustrate how people are saved. In my opinion, it's not even there to tell us what happens to people after they're dead, although it does use that scenario for the story. I think the story is a parable. And I think Jesus uses the scene to set up the story to give the final lesson. Now, many people think the lesson of the story is that the rich man should have been more generous, and he went to hell for not being generous. Well, that is a feature of the story, but that's not the end of it. That's just the story moves through that point to its final point, and its final point is this: that the rich man in hell or in Hades, he wishes that his brothers who are still on earth could be warned about this, so they wouldn't have to end up
exactly.
there. Which is actually kind of a nice thing. He's not thinking about himself. He's thinking about others and wants to see them saved. But he's told it won't do any good. He suggests, why don't you send Lazarus back from the dead and then he can tell them. And he said, they'll certainly believe somebody who rises from the dead. But Abraham said, well, let them read Moses and the prophets. And he said, oh, they won't read them and they won't believe them, but they'll believe someone who comes back from the dead. And here's the point of the parable. The last words mm-hmm. in it, Abraham says, if they don't hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded by a man who comes back from the dead. Now, Jesus had earlier in John chapter 5 castigated the Pharisees because he said, I'm not going to accuse you before God. Moses is going to accuse you before God because you don't read and listen to him. If you had listened to Moses, you would listen to me. What he's saying mm-hmm. is, you've never really been open to God's messengers. You already had Moses and the prophets, and you don't listen to them. And that's no doubt why you don't listen to me either, because you're just not disposed to listen to God's messengers at all. And that's the same point of that parable. If they're not reading Moses and the prophets and believing them, Abraham said, then they won't believe when a man rises from the dead either. Now, of course, in the story of the parable, it's Lazarus, who's coming back from the dead, was being contemplated. But, of course, the message is, there is going to be a man who will come back from the dead, and those who are already rejecting Moses and the prophets would not believe just because of that. In fact, Jesus never even really appeared to the unbelievers after he rose from the dead. Just his brother James and later Saul of Tarsus, but all the other people, all the other hundreds of people he appeared to were all believers. And, you think, well, why didn't he go and appear to the unbelievers? Well, they had Moses and the prophets. If they're not going to believe Moses and the prophets, why would they believe one who rises from the dead? That's the point of the parable.
Okay, awesome. Thank you for shedding some light on that, Steve.
Okay, Chris, God bless you. Okay, our next caller is Andrew from Everett, Washington. Andrew, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve, thank you. Sure. So I wanted to find out, is there a difference between the gift of faith and the saving faith? And then maybe like a follow-up question, like, for example, is the saving faith, is that something that's God-given, or is that something that people just come to terms on their own. Like, because like the reason that I ask that, because like when there are revivals.
Hello? Oh, he must have gotten cut off. Well, I'll answer the question. Is there a difference between the gift of faith and saving faith? Now, the gift of faith is a reference to 1 Corinthians 12, where Paul lists nine gifts of the Holy Spirit, and one of them is the gift of faith. But it's not saving faith he's talking about there, because he says to one, he means to one Christian, is given the word of wisdom, to another the word of knowledge, to another faith, to another the working of miracles, to another prophecy, and so forth. So he's talking about the gift of faith as one of the gifts that some Christians have, as opposed to other gifts that other Christians have. So he's not talking about the universal experience of all Christians, which is saving faith. He's talking about something additional to saving faith. He's talking about some people have been given exceptional faith, which is, you know, we don't know exactly how that's understood function, but we might see people like George Mueller or Hudson Taylor or people who lived by faith in a unique way as having a gift that other people don't have. I don't know. The gift of faith is never explained, but saving faith is not necessarily called a gift. Now, some people think it is. In Ephesians 2, 8 and 9, it says, by grace you've been saved through faith, and that, not of yourself, it is the gift of God, not of works, lest anyone should boast. So some people think that Paul's saying that faith is the gift of God. That's not what he's saying. Faith is, in the Greek, a feminine word, and it is the gift of God. The word it is a neuter word, and in Greek grammar, the pronoun agrees in gender with the antecedent noun. So he's not referring back to faith as the gift of God, and he's not even referring back to grace, because that also is a feminine word in Greek. So it's neither the grace nor the faith that is the gift of God. It's the being saved is the gift of God, not of works. So by grace you have been saved through faith. It, what, being saved, is not of works. It is the gift of God. So that's the verse that people usually use to say that faith is a gift, that saving faith is a gift, but they're misunderstanding it. I think they're ignoring or unaware of the Greek grammar that would forbid that. All right, let's talk to Dale from Spokane, Washington. Dale, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm calling about the passage in the book of John where Peter enters a tomb and sees the folded napkin, the handkerchief that was covering Jesus' head.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, he sees it separate from the other burial clothes.
Yeah.
What do you think the significance of that?
I've heard several people give it a significance that I cannot verify. And this is perhaps just a preaching point. I don't know if this is really true, but a number of teachers have said, and I don't know where they got the information, that in the Middle East, when a person leaves the table, if they are not coming back to the table, they leave their napkin crumpled up on the table, and that lets the servants know they're done. But if they're going to come back to the table, they fold it up and leave it folded so that the servants don't clear their space. And some feel that since Jesus folded up the napkin that had covered his head, that he was sort of sending a coded message, I'll be back. But I do not know if that is really true. It may be true. I have not been able to verify it from any sources. The fact that it was separate and folded up does suggest at least one important thing, and that is that it was not a grave robbery, because a person robbing a grave would not stop to fold up the grave clothes before hauling off the body. Usually burglars are in haste and they don't clean up after themselves. So it would suggest at least this much, that Jesus, before he left, sort of made his bed, sort of speak. He left it tidy. That's all we can really be sure about. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.